Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, May 24th. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, May 26th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Baldwin Creek in Wilder Ranch State Park. This lovely coastal spot is calling us back, and it's time to go scope it out. There will be plenty of various weedy mustard species, and we will definitely check out the Cape Ivy sites and determine our course of action. We will meet up at Wilder Ranch and carpool to our work site. See you there at 10 a.m. To get to Wilder Ranch, take Highway 1 north through Santa Cruz and continue to the turnoff for Wilder Ranch on the left-hand side of the road. There is a sign indicating a left turn. When you get to the kiosk, tell the person there that you are volunteering for habitat restoration, and they will give you a parking pass. The group will meet you at the interpretive sign by the bathrooms in the parking lot. Once again, please be on time at 10 a.m. this Saturday, May 26th, for habitat restoration on Baldwin Creek. And Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project is inviting you to their celebratory campout at Walton Lake in Ochoco National Forest. That's in Oregon, I believe, on June 9th. They're celebrating the stopping of the Forest Service from logging the old-growth forest at Walton Lake for the second time and inviting people to learn about and enjoy this ecologically important and unique area with us and celebrate the forest around the lake is still there. They'll be camping at the Walton Lake Recreation Area in the Ochoco National Forest. There are limited spaces available in their group campsite, and there are other camping in the campground. They also have dispersed campsites outside of the recreation area where people are welcome to camp. If you'd like a reservation, contact paula.e.hood@gmail.com. That's paula.e.hood@gmail.com to RSVP for the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project's campout at Walton Lake on June 9th. And California black bears are on the move in this story from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. This is their yearly bear warning. California's black bears are active and hungry after a period of hunkering down through the winter. As a reminder, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife encourages people to help reduce unwanted encounters with this large mammal by being bear aware. People who visit or live in bear country can take actions that promote responsible behavior and safe coexistence with bears. Black bears are the only bear species in California. Grizzlies were hunted out earlier in the last century. They generally prefer mountainous areas and natural habitats. However, as more people visit parks and wilderness areas or choose to live in and near bear habitat, some bears may become used to the presence of people and as a result display less shy and avoidant behavior. Over the years, reported human-bear conflicts have increased significantly, said Vicky Monroe, CDFW's Wildlife Conflict Programs Coordinator. Each spring and summer, we receive numerous calls from the public reporting anything from black bears eating food off campground picnic tables to bears taking dips in residential swimming pools. Black bears have a diverse diet and can eat nearly anything from berries and insects to pet food, human trash, and roadkill. They also have a highly specialized sense of smell, which can sometimes lead them to enter homes, cabins, and tents while following their nose and stomach to a food source. Local communities and areas of human activity in and around bear habitat can provide a tempting food supply for a hungry bear. However, unwanted and/or destructive bear activity may significantly be reduced or even eliminated when people are mindful and remember to remove attractants and access to food. Here's some tips for bear-proofing your home, your rental, or your timeshare. Bears may venture into areas of human activity close to bear habitat in search of food. The best defense against bear break-ins and bears in your yard is to eliminate attractants to your property by following these tips. Purchase and properly use a bear-proof garbage container. Wait to put out trash until the morning of collection day. Do not leave trash, groceries, or pet food in your car. Keep garbage cans clean and deodorize them with bleach or ammonia. Keep barbecue grills clean and stored in a garage or shed when not in use. Do not hang bird feeders in bear country. If you must, do so only during November through March and make them inaccessible to bears. Do keep in mind that bears are excellent climbers. Do not leave any scented products outside, even non-food items such as suntan lotion, insect repellent, soap, or candles. Keep your doors and windows closed and locked when you're not home. Consider installing motion detector alarms and/or electric fencing. Harvest fruit off of the trees as soon as it is ripe and collect any fruit that falls on the ground. Bring your pets in at night. Provide safe and secure quarters for livestock at night. Consider composting bins as opposed to open compost piles. Securely block access to potential hibernation sites such as crawl spaces under your decks and buildings. Do not spray bear spray around your property. When it dries, it can serve as an attractant. Do not feed deer or other wildlife. This will attract bears to your property. Tips for bear-proofing around your campsite. Maintaining a clean campsite is the responsible and safe thing to do when visiting bear country. Haul your garbage out of camp regularly. Check with your camp host or other camp personnel about safe garbage storage and use bear lockers when available. Store food, including pet food and toiletries, in bear-proof containers or an airtight container in the trunk of your vehicle if bear lockers are not available. The back of pickup trucks are not bear-proof. In some areas, food storage in the trunk is not advisable. Check with camp or park personnel. Clean dishes and store food in garbage immediately after meals. Clean your barbecue grill after each use. Never keep food or toiletries in your tent. Change out of clothes you cooked in or ate in before going to bed. Do not clean fish in your camp. Do not leave pets unattended in camp or sleeping outside. If in the backcountry, store food in a bear-resistant food canister or off the ground at least 10 feet in the air. Use bear-resistant ice chests. Some jurisdictions will only allow ice chests that are approved as bear-resistant. If you're hiking, bears may react defensively if your presence is not known. Don't sneak up on a bear, make noise while hiking, talk loudly, or whistle. If possible, travel with a group of people. Avoid thick brush and walk with the wind at your back so your scent is ahead of you. Watch for bear sign along trails, scat tracks, and strip bark off of trees. Avoid sites where dead animal carcasses are observed. If you see a bear, avoid it and give it an opportunity to avoid you. Put your dog on a leash when hiking in bear country. Dogs can surprise and aggravate bears, bringing the bear back to you when the dog flees. Black bear behavior is not always predictable. Human bear attacks are rare in California, however, they do occur. There is no single safety strategy applicable to every bear encounter. Individual bears can display varying levels of tolerance and temperament. Prevention is better than confrontation. Keep as much distance as possible between you and the bear and share this information with your children. Make sure they know to tell you if they see a bear in the area. If a bear breaks into your home, do not confront the bear. Most bears will quickly look for an escape route, move away to a safe place. Do not block exit points. If the bear does not leave soon, call 911. If you encounter a bear in your yard, chances are it will move on if there's nothing for the bear to eat. If there is enough distance between you and the bear, you can encourage the bear to leave by using noisemakers or blowing a whistle. If you encounter a bear while hiking and it does not see you, back away from the bear and increase your distance. Clap your hands, yell, or make noise, beat on pots and pans so that the bear knows you are there and will move on. If you encounter a bear on the trail and it sees you, do not make eye contact. Back away slowly, do not run. Let the bear know you are not a threat and give it a chance to leave. If a bear approaches you, make yourself look bigger by lifting and waving your arms. Use noisemakers, yell at the bear. If small children are present, keep them close to you. Carry and know how to use bear spray as a deterrent. In the event of a black bear attack, it is usually recommended to fight back. However, each situation is different and prevention is the key. If you have need for further information, please go to calfire.ca.gov. And leaving with a promise, Nutty ends her tree sit in this story by Appalachians Against Pipeline from It's Going Down, as found in the Earth First Newswire. After almost 2 months, tree sitter Nutty has ended her tree sit, but more have gone up. Stay tuned. We have a story on that following. Here's Nutty's statement. If you're reading this, it means the monopod blockade is no more. We knew it couldn't last forever. That's how it works. If we rely on only one location, one tactic, or one group of people to stop this pipeline, we will fail. But we're not. I know that as this one facet of the struggle draws to conclusion, more people in other places are gaining momentum. The fire has already caught. We must not let it die out. It was a painful decision to come down. The food ran out on May 19th. The water was still plentiful, but as Fern defends the same road, a few more days of growing weaker before starting the process of recovering from this and figuring out other ways to fight didn't make sense to me. And yet I don't know how I can explain this to you in a way that didn't seem like a defeat. I can only remind you and myself that this was never about one action, but about a multifaceted struggle that will continue in each of us who tries to act, to live each moment in defiance of all that would make us silent, obedient, and governable. Yesterday I knew that it was the last night I would spend here. I looked up at the stars and the moon, at the leaves lit by floodlights, looking for the right words, but finding only the hardness in my throat and tears in my eyes. At what will they will do to this piece of road when I'm gone? At all the countless struggles that end in mourning and in loss. This morning I tried to listen for what it was I should say in the harshly beautiful calls of ravens and came up with the same answer, that words are not enough. No words can speak the full truth of 8 weeks spent here. No matter what I make of them, my words cannot conjure fire. If they have fed some flame already in you, then they have done their work. If they can call forward in me at times to come when I want to give in and hide from everything, then they will have done all that I can hope for. I am leaving with a promise, a commitment born of long days and nights lying over 40 feet up in a monopod, and of 22 years learning that I exist within a civilization that I would rather die fighting than live quietly within. This is a battle happening everywhere, and I want to keep finding my place in it. For the moment, in the wild and beautiful terrain of Appalachia, we are still here. We are still trying. They are still trying to put a pipeline through. So let's keep learning from each other what is possible, build our skills and equipment with tactics. Let's equip our defenses against those who would constrain us. If anyone was still unsure before, events thus far should have shown us that the cops in this state stand where they have always stood, on the side of the powerful, of exploitation, of turning land and water into profit. Let's dig deeper than this single pipeline struggle to attack the roots of what is ruining our world, confronting internal as well as external patterns and assumptions, facing the violent histories that still find their home in the present. This land was already stolen, and private property shouldn't exist any more than this pipeline should. This fight didn't begin with this pipeline, and it won't end until the destruction of colonialism, white supremacy, capitalism, patriarchy, governance, everything weakening destruction, wreaking destruction on the earth and waging constant war on certain human beings to create empty structures of wealth and power. Let's let what we learn in this struggle reach into every corner of our lives, even as our lives and relationships meld inextricably with our actions. Let's build friendships and commitments strong enough to withstand the long fight ahead. It's going to be very, very hard. I think we've only gotten glimpses of what we'll need to achieve to stop this pipeline. Yet if those glimpses are any indication, the coming months and the coming years and lifetimes fighting the many facets of the world we're trying to destroy will contain not only grueling effort and frequent moments of doubt, but also unexpected joy, laughter, and triumph. So keep on fighting and growing communities that have no room for pipelines or their world. I hope to see you in the mountains, in the streets, by the rivers, and in the fields and wetlands and the forests. Signed, Nutty. And in Virginia, another tree sit goes up against the Mountain Valley Pipeline in this story from Appalachians Against Pipelines, as found in the Earth First Newswire. Early Monday morning, pipeline protesters in Jefferson National Forest erected a new aerial blockade on Pocahontas Road near Narrows, Virginia. The blockade consists of a protester on a platform 30 feet in the air, suspended from a horizontal rope tied to surrounding trees. Banners at the site read, "Which side are you on?" and "Still here." Pocahontas Road is a Forest Service road and Mountain Valley Pipeline access road that leads to the construction site for MVP's intended boring through Peters Mountain under the Appalachian National Scenic Trail. The presence of this roadblock prevents MVP's continued construction of the access road and boring site, which has already been significantly delayed for well over 50 days by the presence of protester Nutty in an aerial blockade on the same road less than 3 miles away. I'm taking a stand on Peters Mountain to prevent further devastation of these lands by Mountain Valley Pipeline, said Fern McDougall, a protester suspended in the new blockade. Cutting through delicate karst topography and 300 miles of contiguous forest and family farms seized by eminent domain, MVP threatens to damage the health and well-being of poor and oppressed communities along the pipeline route. By threatening the air, soil, and water, this pipeline will catalyze the growth and expansion of gas extraction across Appalachia, an industry which has already caused permanent harm to many communities. We are dedicated to resisting this reckless endangerment of the land and people as long as MVP continues to operate. McDougall further stated that she was inspired to take this action by monopod sitter Nutty and by David Buckle, an LGBTQ rights lawyer who died in April after setting himself on fire as a protest against the use of fossil fuels. And here's the update from the field from the Buffalo Fields campaign. In the wake of great harm, the central herd attempts to make a comeback. It's been a pretty mellow week here with the buffalo. We've had very few instances of buffalo along the highway, but there is one big bull that's starting to stretch his legs into some of the newly gained year-round habitat. He was headed north of Fir Ridge along Highway 191, moving out of the Hebgen Basin further north than we've seen a buffalo go in many years. He's making us a bit nervous, though, as he's in a tight forested section and staying close to the road. If he continues north, the land will open up a bit, and even if he continues even further north, he could potentially be the first buffalo to make it to the Taylor Fork in over two decades. There are some organizations and agencies who have wanted to capture and transport buffalo to the Taylor Fork, but we keep saying that if they want to be there, they will go. We're keeping a close eye on this amazing guy who is showing other humans who want to make them do things that, if given time and space, they will be the ones to show us the way. Around the Hebgen Basin, central herd members continue to bring forth new life. Calving season got off to a bit of a late start, but now every day we are seeing more and more calves. Except for a few short hazing operations and the challenges of the highway, the buffalo are at peace here. Moms can give birth without disturbance, and calves are able to run, play, and grow strong without the threat of being hazed. While the central herd's numbers are drastically down, our highest count here has been lower than 250 in the Hebgen Basin and less than 100 counted on recons into Yellowstone's interior, every single calf who is born is a symbol of resistance and effort to make a comeback from Yellowstone's senseless slaughter. Each calf is a celebration for the buffalo's future, and we want you all to celebrate with us. So instead of a lot of words here, the webpage is showing you a bunch of really cute pictures of young buffalo. And if you'd like to see those pictures, please go to the webpage www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And grizzly bear hunting has been approved for Wyoming for the first time in 43 years in this story by Samuel Osborne of The Independent, as found on the Earth First Newswire. State wildlife officials have approved Wyoming's first grizzly bear hunt in 44 years. The decision allows hunters to shoot and kill as many as 22 grizzlies in total in a wide area to the south and east of Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. It comes after the Trump administration decided to delist the animals that threaten species in the region, an idea formally proposed in 2016 under the Obama administration. The move was based on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service findings, which suggested the bears' numbers had recovered sufficiently in recent decades that federal safeguards were no longer necessary. Since the decision, environmental activists have sued the U.S. government in an attempt to restore the grizzly's federal protected status, urging climate change and poaching still threaten the species' viability. The region, which also includes parts of Montana and Idaho, is home to around 700 grizzly bears. Montana has not yet allowed grizzlies to be hunted, but Idaho will allow one to be hunted in September. Slow to reproduce, grizzlies number fewer than 2,000 in the lower 48 states compared to a historic high of 100,000 before widespread shooting, poisoning, and trapping reduced their numbers to several hundred by 1975 when they were placed under federal protection. They are also the heart of a cultural divide between Native Americans who revere the bears and ranchers and others who see them as potential threats to livestock and a potential impediment to further mining, logging, and fossil energy development. The decision, approved 7-0 by the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission, was denounced by tribal leaders. "This is a sacred thing that is central to our religious and life ways," said Brian Jackson of the Blackfoot Confederacy. "This is not a hunting issue. This is a killing issue." But others welcomed the opportunity to hunt in order to keep grizzly numbers in check. I know management seems to have gotten a dirty name, but that's the way we have to do it if we want these animals to continue in the state, said Charles Price, a rancher and former Game and Fish Commissioner. Hunting must be part of the management system. Previously, bear baiting was decided to be potentially unsafe and inconsistent with federal laws, but the Trump administration has proposed scrapping the rules banning hunters from using bait to lure grizzly bears into the open. And a proposal would lift federal restrictions on hunting bears and wolves in Alaska in this story by Noel Kirkpatrick of the Mother Nature Network. A proposed rule change from the National Park Service and directed by the Department of Interior would roll back federal regulations that prohibited certain hunting practices in national preserves in Alaska, including baiting brown bears, using spotlights to hunt hibernating black bears, and killing wolves and pups in their dens. These methods are currently allowed under Alaskan law as part of a predator control plan that is at least partially aimed at increasing hunting opportunities, but the practices were banned by a federal ruling in 2015. The conservation of wildlife and habitat for future generations is a goal we share with Alaska, Bert Frost, the Park Service's regional director, said in a statement to the Associated Press. This proposed rule will reconsider NPS efforts in Alaska for improving alignment of hunting regulations on national preserves with state of Alaska regulations and to enhance consistency with harvest regulations on surrounding non-federal lands and waters. The 2015 federal regulations also banned shooting swimming caribou from a motorboat and hunting black bears with dogs. Thor Stacey, director of the Government Affairs for the Alaska Professional Hunter Association, framed it as a correction on government control. This was a case of the federal government overstepping and trying to usurp the state's authority to manage its wildlife, Stacey told Reuters. Conservationists and animal rights advocates denounced the move by National Park Service and the Department of Interior. These federal lands are havens for wildlife, and the National Park Service is mandated to manage these ecosystems in a manner that promotes conservation, Anna Frostick, a lawyer for the Humane Society of the United States, told AP. This proposed rule, which will allow inhumane killing of our native carnivores in a misguided attempt to increase trophy hunting opportunities, is unlawful and must not be finalized. The rule change was announced May 22nd in the Federal Register and is open for comment until July 23rd. If the comment period passes without further changes, the proposal would allow the State Department of Fish and Game to set hunting and trapping rules within national preserves. And a guest column by Eric Fernandez, as written in the Bulletin of Bend, Oregon. The Bulletin recently reported on the status of Oregon's wolf recovery. Top-line numbers showed cause for celebration, but a deeper dive shows another public agency that has lost its way. Exactly 124 wolves have been counted in Oregon. That's 123 more than just a decade ago. But imagine if there were only 124 salmon or deer or eagles in the state. Would we be declaring mission accomplished, arguing for trophy hunting and making it easier to kill them? By any reasonable measure, wolf recovery remains fragile. Before wolves were permanently stripped of state endangered species protections in 2015, wolves were on a better trajectory. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's press releases glossed over the fact that in the past 3 years, wolf killing has increased. The number of packs and breeding pairs has not grown at all. Until 2015, Oregon had clear requirements for non-lethal measures meant to prevent conflict with livestock. Under those provisions, the wolf population grew and conflict decreased. That's what everyone says they want: fewer dead livestock, fewer dead wolves, and fewer angry people. Now, amidst a poaching epidemic, the state continues to set the bar ever lower for non-lethal requirements and when wolves can be killed. The result? More conflict and more killing. Omitted from the bulletin story is that Governor Kate Brown's agency just permitted the killing of 5 members of the Pine Creek wolf pack, including a pregnant female. The beneficiary is a livestock manager at the center of the controversy surrounding fraud and abuse of the state's wolf compensation program. Allowing the killing of a pregnant female calls into question the state's moral compass. And that's on top of a modern record for wolf killing in 2017. Most of the last year's killing was done to appease the state's most vocal anti-wolf activist. With a compensation program already in place, this isn't pay up or the wolf gets it, it's pay up and the wolf gets it. That does not bode well for the future of our wildlife. The return of wolves to their rightful place on the landscape is good news for those who care about healthy ecosystems, natural wild, native wildlife, and Oregon's conservation ethic. If the state is ever to move past unnecessary conflict and a token persecuted population of wolves, something needs to change. Like all wildlife, wolves evoke strong emotions. For those of us, wolves are a symbol of freedom, wilderness, and the American West. They provide an economic opportunity and healthier wildlife populations. But they remain at the center of a stubborn campaign of misinformation and fear. Wolves make good scapegoats, but little context is important. Each year, over 50,000 of Oregon's 1.3 million cows die from things like weather disease, domestic dogs, and theft. Last year, only 11 unattended calves were killed by wolves. Though compensation was available for every loss, ODFW issued kill orders for 10 wolves. Coexisting with native wildlife is a responsibility we all share, especially those of us lucky enough to live near the big wild places of the American West. We can do it without resorting to 19th century solutions like bullets, traps, and poisons. It's time for Governor Brown to step up. She needs to rein in her rogue agencies so they can begin honoring their mission and rebuilding trust with Oregonians who value all native wildlife. Wolves would be a good place to start. Oregon's wolf plan is now 3 years out of date. The plan should ensure killing wolves is truly an option of last resort. Rather than follow the leads of states like Idaho and Wyoming, Oregon can look to provisions in place from 2013 to 2015, when Oregon was a national leader in wolf recovery. The alternative is the path we're currently on: more dead livestock, more dead wolves, and more angry people. Eric Fernandez is the Wilderness Program Manager for Oregon Wild in Bend, Oregon. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. for a rebroadcast of this show. That's Friday at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also tune to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning, KBOG 97.9 in Bandon, Oregon, Fridays at 10 a.m., KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., and WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon, KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 in Berkeley, California, all rebroadcast the Earth First Update. Tune into their webpage for the day and time. Or, if you want to, you can always go to the webpage radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous Earth First Update anytime you want. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It's free to download and rebroadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.